now, broadcasting on StarWorldWideNetworks.com. It's time for Dr. Rademacher's Prescription for Transformation. Let's tap into your own authentic genius and live the life you desire. Join Dr. Rademacher for an enlightened conversation about our brain intelligence, our body intelligence, and our energy intelligence. And now, here's your host, Dr. Bart Rademacher.
I'm Dr. Bart Rademacher, and this is Prescription for Your Transformation. Real people, real conversations, and real success. And it's interesting because we're almost at that cutoff point in the beginning of this year, this beginning of this decade of 21 days. It's January 16th, when most people who had the courage or wherewithal, if you will, to decide that they were going to resolve to do new things this year or this decade. It's called New Year's resolutions. And science actually demonstrates how quickly people fall off. So at the beginning of the year, all the new memberships, you know, grow instantly, really high. And then within days, weeks, you know, people just kind of fall off. And so today is relevant. Today is relevant because it's really all about your personal wellness. And myself being in the industry for a very long time, as a plastic and reconstructive and regenerative surgeon, what was interesting is that as I was helping people with their physical transformation and absolutely changing their lives in a magnificent way, I realized it wasn't enough. And for the last 20 years in my practice, in one form or another, I've always incorporated different aspects of personal wellness. Whether it was with the mind or the body, it was an important part of what it was that I did. And in that journey, I was very fortunate to meet a man that I believe is absolutely brilliant and has helped me personally in that journey to optimize my own personal wellness. And he's a concierge doctor here in the Tampa Bay region in Florida. And really what I totally respected and honored about his approach is he always came from the perspective that, you know, he's my partner in my wellness and my health. And so not dictating to me what it was that I needed to do, but you know, very effectively either educating me and guiding me to start making the right decisions. And so I'm really excited to be introducing Dr. Eric Kroll. He's been on the show before and really helping people understand some of the beautiful things that are now currently available to us so that we can optimize our own well-being, understanding that a lot is immediately accessible and doesn't cost you anything. And so we're going to review some of those things today and also dive in into some really cool stuff that are complementary to the work that I do in regenerative medicine. But what are some of the things that we can do to optimize the body? So Dr. Kroll, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Bart.
So it's a great pleasure and honor to be with you, really because of your approach. And I know you're the traditional family doctor, but more importantly is how you've really tackled the evolving science of wellness and helping people do the right things by the right testing, making the right choices. And for example, one thing that was instrumental in your practice is evaluating the carotid arteries with ultrasound to see what kind of risks we were for cardiac disease. So I want to jump in first, some of the basics. When we talk about sleep, nutrition, exercise, and mind balance, what are your thoughts on that before we go into the really nitty gritty, the meaty stuff?
Well, I mean, obviously to have complete wellness, you have to be well physically, emotionally, and spiritually. And physical wellness, sleep is a great place to start because we can have plans laid out for how we're going to lose weight or lower blood pressure or lower cholesterol. Your tank running low on 4 hours of sleep. Sleep is a great place to start. Just the quality of sleep is all related. You know, if you're not mentally well, you're dealing with depression or anxiety, that's affect your ability to sleep.
Right. Yeah, I just want to interrupt you there for a second, Eric. You know, we recognize a problem with your mic beforehand, and you're kind of in and out again. So anything you can do just to have that steady voice, amazing voice of yours.
Yeah, well, my father's a deacon, so I'll have to use my deacon voice.
All right.
Yeah, the sleep is a great place to start. It's related to so many other things. We can have the best plans laid out for how we're going to improve health, but if your tank's low from 4 hours of sleep or from interrupted sleep, it really doesn't matter. So all these things are interconnected. As you know, if you're dealing with depression or mental illness, that impacts your sleep. There's so much more appreciation now for sleep apnea, which often goes undetected. So there are things that affect the quality of people's sleep that actually can be, you know, identified, corrected, balanced to then improve the quality of the sleep.
Right. Yeah, I've incorporated a couple of new changes in my life. And first of all, eliminating the blue light in my sleep areas, minimizing or just removing all sorts of digital exposure for at least 2 hours prior to going to sleep. And a tough one for me, though, is making sure that I don't eat for at least 3 hours, maybe 4 hours beforehand. You know, sometimes I have late nights, like tonight. You know, we won't be done to about 7:30 p.m. And then my bedtime is actually like 9:30. So I'm going to have a late dinner before I go to bed. But it's amazing how it's helped me acquire enough sleep, which has now become non-negotiable. 8 hours of sleep every night, it's made a huge difference for me. I haven't lost the weight yet that I wanted to, but I understand that with inadequate sleep, that there's a tendency to keep your weight on. Is that right?
Oh, that's correct. And we talk about things like sleep hygiene. Sleep hygiene, there are things that we can do that you might think sound silly, but for example, you shouldn't read or watch TV in your bed because your brain is powerful enough to associate laying in your bed with things other than sleep. A really important one that a lot of people highlight. And sometimes it's helpful to keep a notepad by your nightstand, a notepad you would never use other than to write down all the things that are on your mind, the things that you need to make sure you get done the next day. You just write them down. If you actually write them down on a notepad and put that back in your nightstand and close the door, it's very symbolic of just dealing with that and releasing it and freeing your mind, then just get to the task of going to sleep. So those kind of simple sleep hygiene measures make a big difference and are better than using sleep drugs, you know, to help you get into a healthy sleep pattern.
Right. So I have a question for you, and I'm curious about this one because I was always very proud that I could, you know, fall to sleep like instantly. I mean, I was asleep before my head, you know, hit the pillow. But I'm hearing that that's probably not the most ideal, that you really want to get into sleep in a slow manner. Is that true? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
You know, I'm not really up on some of that information. I have not heard that. The latest things that I've heard, the closest thing to that I've heard is that it's really important that you go to sleep and wake up at roughly the same time. And that's a tough one because most people have a different wake-up time on the weekends than they do during the week. But it's actually healthy if you set the same wake-up time 7 days a week. That's a tough one.
Yeah, I actually like to get up at 5:30, so I do get my...
To answer your question, I'm not really...
Right. So I think I lost there for a second. So, yeah, no, you did answer my question. But the, you know, I get my 8 hours. I wake up at 5:30. But one thing I've actually heard, too, and we'll jump to the next topic on nutrition, but what I've also heard that some, you know, of these celebrity athletes or super athletes, as I like to call them, you know, they sleep good 10, 12 hours a day. I mean, yeah, sure, their athletics are pretty intense, but they require a lot of sleep.
Yeah, I'm not I'm not really sure of the science behind why someone would really require more than 8 hours. I mean, 8 hours is generally regarded as plenty of time for the body to heal and repair all the stress from the day before. And right. So I'd be interested to know what scientific why someone would require more than 8 hours.
Yeah, I'll have to look it up. But moving on to, let's say, exercise, and then definitely talk about nutrition, and then get into the real meat of this talk today. You know, and again, it's clear that exercise and movement is critical. I think today, you know, we have a new condition called the sitting disease. And for those out there who are not quite familiar with that, but people who are sitting consistently for 6 to 8 hours a day, which is most of us, even driving counts in that. And I guess what happens after about 20 minutes is that the enzymes within the walls of the blood vessels shut down. And so it causes accumulation of fats and cholesterol that can significantly impact your cardiovascular system. And so give us some of your thoughts about what people should be doing as far as movement.
Yeah, exercise needs to incorporate all the main areas being cardiovascular fitness and then adequate flexibility and then muscular strengthening. So a good exercise regimen really does have to include all three. And we've evolved on the cardiovascular part. You know, we used to say, you know, you have to do 30 minutes 5 days a week. We've evolved that to where the minimum for all Americans who want to be healthy is to accumulate 150 minutes a week. So you can decide whether you want that to be 3 days, 5 days, or get it all in 2 days. But the minimum would be to at least accumulate 150 minutes a week of a moderate intensity activity. And when I say moderate intensity, I mean, you know, a walk at least, you know, a 3.5 mile per hour pace or so, or cycling at 12 to 14 mile per hour pace or something equivalent like that. And then the flexibility piece is huge for injury prevention. As we go about our daily activities, twisting, turning, moving, the ligaments and muscles are stiff and they're pulling on joints and throwing off. Not being adequately flexible has far-reaching effects on our health. There's a lot of information about how the outflow of nerve information from our spine to our body affects so many of our body processes, and that is all thrown out of whack when we don't maintain adequate physical activity, including flexibility. And then third, the muscular strengthening is critical because, you know, there's so many things that occur with age, which we'll get to later, but a big factor aside from hormones is just the loss of lean body mass that occurs over time. And that leads to a greater accumulation of body fat, which then leads to cardiometabolic diseases like diabetes and heart disease. So maintaining your core muscles throughout your adult life to minimize that loss of lean body mass, it's not only to prevent injuries and strain on our joints, it's to make sure that we are able to maintain a healthy body fat level to ward off disease. So those three core elements must be attended to throughout our adult life.
You know, and my journey has been trying to figure out, you know, what's the best, you know, exercise regimen. And I just recently started swimming again. And I'm telling you, it feels tremendous, you know, to do that because it's really exercising or, you know, mobilizing or moving every part of me, flexing all that. And, but also without a lot of the strain. And I was finding at times that even if I was on the treadmill or in the elliptical, that I would, you know, it was easy for me to get injured simply because of the strain of that. And swimming has, you know, proven to be pretty amazing. And so, in fact, I just went for my half hour swim just about an hour ago. So one of the things that I'm very excited about, and I checked in with you recently about the validity of this and the value of it as well. And, you know, I need to lose, I'm working on losing another 10, 15 pounds to get back to my ideal weight.
So this time it's staying on.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it, you know, the hard part is just letting go of my wine. Where is my wine? And I understand that alcohol is really not good because it induces estrogen and that then causes more weight gain and inflammation and all those kinds of things. But the exciting part is, you know, I've tried a variety of different, you know, diets, and I'm always getting excited because trying something new. And I was super excited when I launched into the keto diet, because then I got to eat as many eggs and cheese and bacon as I wanted, and all those things that I wanted. All I had to do is give up bread and rice and pasta. Personally didn't get a lot of great results with that. And so just recently jumped into a plant-based diet. Started off, you know, January 1st. And so it's, we're got great momentum. So I'm not going to hit that critical point at 21 days and then give up. However, what I've noticed is that I feel lighter. I feel almost like it feels like I'm cleaner. But one thing I want to hear from you, you know, some of the thoughts of the different types of diets out there, and most importantly, your thoughts on intermittent fasting.
Yeah, that's a big topic. That's one of the topics most near and dear to my heart. I think it would be good to start in the big picture and say that when we're talking about diet, we're talking about micronutrients and macronutrients. And when it comes to macronutrients, that's, you know, the carbs, the fat, and the protein. So it's hard for anyone to be an expert. There's so many different theories, but I believe that whatever an individual decides to do as far as the carbs, fat, and protein, that our bodies were made biochemically to experience fasting, and our bodies function best when we allow ourselves to have some period, I would argue 16 hours, but 14 to 16 hours without any fuel coming in. And then we can, that's an easy part. I think everybody, for pregnant women, women who are breastfeeding, and any individual who's underweight shouldn't do intermittent fasting. But for everyone else, intermittent fasting is a very healthy way live. We'll come back and talk about more details about that. I want to address the other part of your question. So our focus on healthy eating is when we're going to eat. That's the intermittent fasting part. You're going to eat over roughly 6 or 8 hours to allow the fasting window. And then the what you're going to eat obviously still matters significantly. So you mentioned keto. I will say that it is any dietary change that someone makes that's designed to lower insulin generally is going to be pretty healthy for you. A keto is designed to eliminate carbs almost completely and allow insulin to come down. And keto is very effective for losing weight. It's very effective for reducing, you know, diabetes and treating diseases of insulin resistance. But I'm a family physician. I have to consider all sources of mortality. So if I'm telling someone to follow a lifestyle like keto, which I know is going to be beneficial for one small area of their health, what about the fact that a high amount of animal fat is known to be carcinogenic? And are they going to live long enough by preventing cardiovascular disease to then experience premature death by cancer from all the animal protein? Well, it's hard to balance all that out, and that's sort of a good segue into plant-based diet, because quitting the animal fat as much as possible is going to be healthy from a preventive standpoint from cancer. And then a plant-based diet in general is going to be higher in carbohydrate, but it's the really good carbohydrate. And so a very healthy combination of a plant-based diet with intermittent fasting, that's sort of the, that's really a healthy way of eating, because the carbohydrate content, it'll spike some insulin, but you have the 16-hour fasting window for your body to process all of that and bring the insulin back down again. So for all the viewers out there who are watching who have been programmed to sort of be intense carbs, and you know, how can you do plant-based with all that, all those carbs? Well, avoiding the carcinogenic effects of the meat and combining it with intermittent fasting, very healthy.
You know, when you think about it, you know, I asked you before we started the show, you know, how long is that intermittent fasting? You know, what's that period? And you started off by saying, you know, it's at least 12 hours by some people. Ideally, it's about 16. But when you think about it, when you do the math, most people probably have dinner, 6 or 7 o'clock at night, and then they have their breakfast, if anything, at 8 a.m. the next morning. Well, that's 14 hours right there. So it's really not that hard.
It's not difficult at all. Even someone who just loves breakfast and they can't imagine fasting because they know how bad they feel when they fast 12 hours to have blood work done. When you do intermittent fasting consistently, it only takes 2 to 3 weeks for your body to start to adapt to using some of its fat for fuel. So then it's not always looking for carbohydrate fuel and leaving you feeling hungry, you know, at the 10, 12 hour point. The body adapts very quickly. And there's not a one-size-fits-all approach, as you know, in any area of medicine. And so the duration of the fast depends on whether the person you're talking to has any of the features of insulin resistance. So someone who has borderline blood sugar or high blood sugar or high triglycerides or high CRP, which is a test we may talk about with inflammation, all these things would indicate that someone has more insulin resistance and they're going to need to do 14 or 16 hours.
Right.
Whereas someone who doesn't fit that category could get significant health benefits with 12 or 14.
So here again, I mean, one of the things that I always encourage is particularly in the work that I do in regenerative medicine is, you know, it's fun to spend all this money on supplements and exercise programs and everything else, but unless you actually measure, you know, what it is that you really need to measure and track that, you really don't know if you're benefiting from any of the changes that you're making. And so obviously checking your blood sugar, I mean, there's monitors out there, you can get them on Amazon easy enough. With CRP, you have to go to your doctor for that. But clearly, you know, looking at those things, what else do you think we should be measuring? I mean, we talked a little bit about micronutrients and cardiometabolic profiles. Share a little bit about that, because, you know, my purpose with this platform, by the way, is to help people understand what are some of the things they can do or promote for others. So what would be some of those tests that you would recommend?
Yeah, one of the things I love about being more of a concierge-type family doctor is that I don't work for any hospitals or insurance companies. I just work for my patients. So I'm not ordering any testing to serve an employer. I'm only ordering things I think are meaningful that are going to help people make healthy decisions. So to your point, I think anybody who has heart disease or family needs to have more than just regular cholesterol. Think you need to have cardiometabolic testing if heart disease runs in your family, because you need to know about eyes and the stickiness of your cholesterol particles and whether you have inflammation with CRP. And there are a multitude of genes that cause premature death to run in families that you're not going to find unless you do an advanced cardiometabolic test. So does everybody need it? No. But someone who has heart disease that runs in their family or runs a risk of premature diabetes should have that more advanced type of cardiometabolic testing. And micronutrient testing, you know, nowadays, as you know, Bart, some of your listeners may not know, and we don't recommend multivitamins for people anymore. We always knew that multivitamins probably didn't do any good, but we thought, can't hurt, so go ahead. But now we know plenty of examples with calcium and vitamin E and vitamin A, that if you take this huge amount in one dose of a micronutrient, it can actually have harmful effects. So we'll use more micronutrient testing to kind of guide therapy, just to see what things you may need, optimal immune system and body function, and then use that to tailor specific supplements body needs, but not just a one-size-fits-all vitamin. And then hormonal testing would be the third piece. I think all men and women, or women in particular, around the, you know, the 40 to 50 time frame as they're approaching menopause, and then even men in their mid-adult life, however you want to describe that. There's lots of hormonal imbalances that will affect sleep, affect optimal bodily functioning. So to do some hormonal testing is a good thing in that age range as well.
You know, it's exciting to see how far we've come along. I remember about 20 years ago when I just had started my practice, and I was a sole practice in plastic and reconstructive and regenerative medicine. And I realized again that, you know, with the physical transformation that I was creating, understanding that there was so much more. And at one point, you know, I started to dive into that, this functional medicine. It wasn't even a term that we knew at that point. And there are certain companies out there, and SpectraCell was probably the only real major player at that time. But, you know, we hadn't reached that level of science and technology to really be able to master that process. But I remember that at one point, I had at least 10 bottles of different vitamins, and because I knew that I had heard the science that, you know, these multivitamins, that pretty much 80 to 90% of what was in that pill was just came out the other end. So it wasn't even absorbed. And so I was getting advice from all these different people, experts, trainers, coaches, try this, try this, try that. And then one day I realized that I was literally, you know, bouncing off the walls. I think my favorite one was Formula 2001, and realized that exactly as you said, I was probably overdosing myself on certain vitamins, and that was seriously unhealthy. And I finally got rid of all of it and then started off with a product called Juice Plus, which really enjoyed liked. But I realized then that the answer was customization. And that's fortunate where we are today, is being able to customize what it is that people need. And so that brings me to the next thing about the Recode of Dale Bredesen. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, because I think for a lot of people, this could have a very serious impact on their lives, their cognitive ability, Alzheimer's for that matter, and discovering what was exciting for me, you know, how we can actually manage Alzheimer's.
Yeah, the Recode protocol by Dr. Bredesen is a true game changer, and it needs to get a lot more notice. You know, in medicine, we tend to focus on things that involve treatment with drugs because, you know, pharmaceutical companies love to do studies on treatments that involve drugs. But, you know, Dr. Bredesen has a protocol which he has shown can reverse Alzheimer's disease, as you know. And he's done this on more than 1,000 patients now. He's unable to get any traditional funding or research because nobody wants to do research on a protocol that involves 36 key elements, you know, that cause Alzheimer's and dementia. So he's going about just continuing to demonstrate that in his own patients. He's written a book. They have centers all around the country now where nutritionists are certified on the Bredesen protocol. There's neurologists that are certified on the Bredesen protocol. Basically, it involves a whole series of testing and supplements to make sure that the 36 things that he has identified are associated with poor cognitive function can all be identified and optimized. And I love the way he describes it. He talks about it as if you had a roof with 36 holes in it, you need to plug all 36 holes or the roof is going to keep leaking. If you can't plug all 36, at least you're going to plug as many of them as you can. And so the 36 holes, if you pack all of them, it's not about slowing Alzheimer's. You can actually reverse it. I mean, this isn't something that is, you know, in a movie that's going to happen in 10 years. It's happening today where people who can't work anymore and can't take care of themselves are being restored to a functional level that allow them to go back to their jobs. And that is possible. So the challenge is Dr. Bredesen does it in a very structured setting. And so when individual doctors out in the community try and accomplish that with their own patients, it's very difficult because the things that have to be done don't just involve taking pills. It involves eliminating refined sugar from the diet, you know, reducing simple carbohydrates, doing fasting. So the RECODE protocol is legit. It's very possible to reverse Alzheimer's disease. But again, it comes back to a lot of the things we're talking about, you know, healthy dietary changes, healthy exercise changes, everything you need to do to reverse and lower insulin, all those things are a critical part of it. But you really have to know who to see and how to go about getting the testing that's necessary to identify all that in order to get the proper guidance on how to reverse it. Reverse it is possible. It's extremely exciting.
You know, and I think the point is very well taken if anybody missed that. And that is this, is that Alzheimer's is caused by your bad choices. So all you have to do is make better choices. And in fact, making better choices for your own personal wellness may result in the fact that you never need to do something like this RECODE. And what that really means is, you know, eating right, exercising, going to sleep, meditation, those kinds of things, you know, reducing inflammation. And of course, if you've reached that point where you are too far gone, not too far gone because you won't remember to do something about it maybe, then it's very easily solvable. And it was exciting to talk to my two kids and my third one. It'll take a little longer for him to get on board. Both of those are exercise nuts and they are plant-based as well. And in fact, all three of us just launched that journey in the last, you know, month. And so it's exciting to know that, you know, in their 20s, they're making smarter choices. And these were the choices that for most Americans, you know, we just were not aware of. And to think that, you know, that we can live till 150 with a little bit of help is very real. And to have that vitality is key. But then again, importantly, is to know this, is that all conditions, in my opinion, and that's my opinion, are reversible. You just have to make smart decisions. You have to do the smart measurements and do all the right thing. As a surgeon, I prefer not to operate. And
if I may, before we leave the Bredesen protocol, you mentioned, I totally agree that the changes that lead to Alzheimer's and dementia, most of them are related to the choices that we make. I wanted to mention the genetic test, the APOE test, because many of your listeners out there who perhaps are, or viewers, I should say, are concerned that there may be risk because of their family. The choices that you make have a huge impact, but an APOE test is very important for someone to have who is concerned about their risk, because that determines the susceptibility right to all these environmental and choices that we make. So you have two copies of the APOE gene, and so you can have a 2, a 3, or a 4. And somebody who has one copy of the 4 is at threefold increased risk of Alzheimer's disease. And someone who inherited both copies, so their APOE 4-4, have a 16-fold increased risk. Doesn't mean they're going to get Alzheimer's, because they can cover all 36 factors that Dr. Bredesen discovered and not get it. But if they have the APOE4/4, it is imperative that without making the proper choices as far as diet and exercise, and I would say even having the Bredesen test done, the risk of Alzheimer's is very high.
You know, it's interesting you talk about that because oftentimes people get super fixated on the genetics. And, you know, the truth is when it comes to genetic profiling, if you will, it's only about 1.2% of all conditions that are strictly genetic without any other influence. The rest, yes, genetics plays a big role, like you said, to double APOE4 or whatever. You know, you're a 16 times risk. And by making smart choices, you can completely avoid, you know, reduce that risk. And that's actually with anything. You know, all of our conditions, our medical conditions, are based on multi-factors. And a lot has to do, you know, with just our, you know, our thinking. So I want to jump to peptides. Really curious. This is a new field for me. Again, you know, the advent of regenerative medicine, I think, is going to be incredibly awesome for all of us. And, you know, it's still a very controversial area. It's still an area where science is evolving. And unfortunately, there are a lot of people out there making all sorts of claims that they shouldn't be making. And with anybody who's interested in that, because maybe traditional medicine hasn't helped, again, we have to come back to the basics. Basics of measurements, basics of lifestyle, basics of nutrition, and things like peptides. So tell us a little bit about that, and also, and we'll dive into some hormonal therapy after that.
Yeah, there's lots of different peptides. Specifically to the peptides that basically naturally stimulate growth hormone. And it's a fascinating area of medicine because, I mean, we've known that there's been a lot of interest in growth hormone in sort of reversing the effects of aging and preventing aging, because we know that it's sort of a slow decline in growth hormone that leads to all kinds of hormonal changes that accelerate aging, the loss of the collagen in our skin, decrease in lean body mass that we talked about accelerates diseases that cause death. So when you inject growth hormone, your body's own natural ability to negative feedback ability on the pituitary gland is overridden. You're just injecting growth hormone. And there are some concerns with that that could not really cause cancer, but if you had any occult hidden cancer, that you could be fueling that. Peptides are kind of a game changer in this area because, well, number one, they're a lot less expensive. And they naturally increase the pituitary gland's output of growth hormone, but it maintains the negative feedback loops in the body. So the body can, you know, not necessarily just putting out a ton of growth hormone that remains unchecked. So the peptides are generally cycled. So you would, it's a once a day injection with a very tiny needle, very small amount. They're really tolerable and easy to use. And you use them daily for 3 weeks and then cycle for a week. Or some people do 5 days on and 2 days off, but you're always kind of cycling them. And it's not just anti-aging. I mean, people use them because the increase in lean body mass and the decrease in cortisol and the ability to shred central body fat is markedly enhanced by using these peptides. And so there's a lot of interest in people who are just, you know, doing everything they can to lose weight, doing everything right, actually, but still having trouble. And when they add the peptides, they really see a drop in the central body fat loss. And then, of course, you know, in people that are really looking at a lot of lean body mass in the body, but muscle, fat. But yeah, it's really advanced to where it's getting expensive, you know, less than $100 a month. and simple to do, and we're not worried as much about the safety like we were with growth hormone by itself.
You know, I really like that concept, because I've always been of the mindset that, you know, we have what's called the body intelligence. You know, my program is all about the three different intelligence: the brain intelligence, the body intelligence, and then the energy intelligence. And so it's really important for us to tap into that intelligence versus hacking it. And I know hacking is a cool term, but then again, giving somebody growth hormone, I think that's a hack. And it can have negative consequences. And particularly for those listening, what happens, what Dr. Carl is explaining, that if you give growth hormone, the system, actually the natural system within the body, shuts down. And so if you suddenly were to remove that growth hormone, then the body would be really short of that hormone and cause all sorts of issues. But when you can naturally stimulate the body to respond accordingly, you know, with introduction of things like peptides, and so giving the body the right resources to do the right thing, I think makes a lot of sense. So my question then is this, you know, with the peptides, so you're saying that that's an intramuscular injection every day?
No, it's subcutaneous. I mean, it's just, you just take a little, you know, a little roll in the abdominal area and inject it. It's a 30 gauge needle or a 31 gauge needle, which is tiny. I mean, honestly, don't feel the needle, because if you just pinch a little bit of skin and put a 31 gauge needle there, you don't feel the needle at all. So,
and for those women who are familiar with Botox, it's that same needle. But how much do you inject?
There's a couple different ones. I will say my personal preference is either somorolin or ipamorelin, because there's less cortisol increase. And so you're going to see less negative impacts on blood glucose. So somorolin or ipamorelin are the two. And generally, with ipamorelin, it's just a 300 microgram dose, anywhere between 300 and 600. So the amount that you inject, you generally order it and dilute it according to the physician's instructions. So you're generally 1 or maybe 0.2 milliliters at most.
Well, I think I'll be knocking on your door for a new script on that one. after I do my testing. So a little bit about the hormones. I know that there's still a lot of confusion in regards to that. I think testosterone is a big one. Your thoughts on testosterone and some of the cautions that we need to consider?
Yeah, with testosterone in particular, a couple years ago, the FDA added warnings about cardiovascular disease. But what we know about testosterone is low testosterone is a risk factor for heart disease.
Right.
But a man who already has heart disease, in the first 90 days after starting testosterone therapy, there is an increase in risk of a cardiovascular event. That's only in men who already have established cardiovascular disease. So, you know, younger, healthier, middle-aged men without a lot of the risk factors, if there's no reason to really be concerned about already having cardiovascular disease, that's really a minor issue. Because, again, getting the testosterone range has positive benefits on lipid parameters that actually would lower the risk. So with hormone replacement for testosterone, there are certainly those that go overboard and try and replace to, you know, super physiologic levels. But in men who are frankly low on their testosterone, or even in the very low normal range, a goal of just getting their body into the level that it's supposed to be, in the mid to upper normal range, that's the goal. It's not to get it, you know, super high. And the challenge is, as you know, a normal testosterone level for men is normal, is 250 to 800. That's a pretty wide normal range. So there's a lot of healthy guys out there injecting a lot of T to get their levels to 1500. I think most men who are interested in optimal health, you know, should be satisfied to know that they're keeping their level, you know, in the, you know, 600, 700, 800 range without a need to go any higher.
Right.
So,
you know, and again, you know, for those out there, it's key with any kind of hormone evaluations. It's also understanding that not all hormonal tests are relevant. And so I think, for example, with testosterone, it's the free T3 for, you know, thyroid hormone. I think it's like the reverse, not the, the reverse, whatever it is. So definitely it's important to understand, you know, which of the tests are relevant. So what are your preferred tests when it comes to, say, testosterone or thyroid hormone or the estrogens?
Yeah, so for test, for the testosterone level, you know, knowing the total and the free is very helpful, and optimizing the DHEA level as well. So that's all part of Dr. Bredesen.
Right.
But when you replace testosterone, you're also going to get some conversion to estrogen in the body.
Right.
But whenever you're doing testosterone replacement, you need to also be monitoring, in addition to the free testosterone, the estrogen level, the DHEA level. In men who are over 50, monitoring the PSA level for the prostate to make sure that, you know, you're not fueling a hidden prostate cancer. I don't think anybody is worried about testosterone causing prostate cancer, because we even give testosterone to men who've already had prostate cancer.
Right.
The goal is just, again, as I said, to get them to the level where they're supposed to be. So for thyroid testing, you need to look at the TSH, which brain is responding to the body's thyroid needs. And then you look at the free T4 and the free T3. And one of the underappreciated tests you alluded to, the reverse T3. Some people, their numbers, some of the numbers look okay, but their body is converting the inactive thyroid to a T3 that doesn't even work.
Right.
And so reverse T3 measures how effectively the thyroid is converting the thyroid precursor to the actual thyroid hormone that the body needs. So it's this full panel that really gives you the idea of where the balance is.
And so, one again, I just wanted to reiterate that it's important for, as a consumer, to understand the relevance of the different tests. And when you have doctors that are not totally familiar with this, but typically your functional medicine doctors, they're in the know. And your special concierge doctors like you are also in the know. But understanding that, you know, the test can be somewhat comprehensive and very useful if you're looking to make some major changes. And definitely for me, I think it's an exciting realm of medicine where we're really kind of dialing in into optimizing, again, that body intelligence, you know, all these different things. And again, that's why I'm super excited about the advent of regenerative medicine, in the hopes that that can support that as well. Again, very cautiously navigating that field, simply because it's an evolving science and we still need to learn so much more. So I know we've talked about a lot of different things today, from peptides to hormones to just the intermittent, you know, fasting. What are some other elements that you think are relevant, you know, for the regular consumer to look at when it comes to their own well-being?
We sure covered a lot of them. The sleep, the dietary piece, the exercise piece, hormonal piece, the micronutrients.
Well, let me ask you this, though. When it comes to peptides, because I'm still curious about that, are there any particular tests that you look into to determine, you know, what kind of peptides you would want to use, and how you then actually select the particular peptide that you want to use?
Well, you don't really need the labs to decide you want to use, because you want to use the ones that are most advantageous, as I said, for cortisol. So really, you're going to use either somorolin or ipamorelin or a combination of the two. And then there's another category, which I didn't, releasing peptides. The most common ones were recently The FDA said, you know, don't use them anymore. So there's a couple newer ones. They don't really have commercial names. They're all named by numbers. But a combination of either ipamorelin with one of these growth hormone releasing hormones or ipamorelin and somorelin together tends to be the ideal. And you don't really need lab data to determine if you're going to do it. One of the lab pieces that you can track while you're doing it is the IGF-1 levels, because anything that's naturally spiking growth hormone, you would tend to see a spike in IGF-1 also. Really, the only blood test, other than the usual stuff, making sure you're not, spiking insulin, spiking blood glucose, is monitoring the IGF-1 as well. But we're usually doing hormone testing, and the IGF-1 is all part of that anyway.
So I guess maybe the real test is, well, if you're fat, then better get on some peptides. And
well, I can appreciate what you're saying. If you are overweight and you're doing, intermittent fasting and you're exercising and you're tracking what you're doing and everything for all intents and purposes should be helping you lose weight, and it's not, you're just at a metabolic disadvantage, then peptides are it. I mean, it's a great addition. So well, I'd love to see someone optimizing everything else first.
And that's a key point, and I agree with you, because way too often people will come to me and says, oh, why don't you do this? Why don't you do some hormone therapy, do the testosterone, or why don't you do some stem cells and do this and do that? And my response has always been, well, you know what, until I've done everything myself, and you and I have had this conversation before, then I'm not going to embark on, these more ambitious therapies. And I wouldn't, maybe ambitious is not quite the right term, but, we have to take responsibility for laying down that foundation first. And it starts off with measuring different things. It starts off with adjusting certain things. And then, if you reach a critical point, well, let's say your blood pressure is too high, then of course go on medication. But I think that most people are consuming way too many medications, and it's a matter of, I would call it, personal agency to say, look, I need to be responsible. I need to be educated. I need to find a doctor like Dr. Kral that I can work with to kind of figure out, how to optimize it. And then if all else fails, then yes, we need to do that. There is one area that I did want to ask you about, which we didn't touch on. And it's interesting because, we only have a few more minutes, by the way. Our bodies have like 70 trillion cells. And I was shocked when I heard that there is another guest in our bodies, and those are the microorganisms, amounting to about 700 trillion cells, I mean, 10 times the number. So things like leaky gut in the microbiome is pretty impressive and important. So I'm giving you 1 minute to share something about your thoughts on that and what we can do for that.
Oh, I'm really glad you asked that. Gut health is a huge part, and we're only beginning to learn, scratch the surface of it. So it is very important for everyone to have healthy diversity of their gut bacteria. And what we're learning is that if you have an imbalance in the gut bacteria, it causes abnormal inflammation in the gut, which then affects the absorption of nutrients. If you use artificial sweeteners to a significant extent, we believe that the metabolism, the way it's metabolized by gut bacteria, interrupts the balance, and that actually a bad balance of gut bacteria can impact someone's ability to lose weight. You never would have guessed that, but we're seeing that occur. So the leaky gut that occurs from losing the proper diversity of all those gut bacteria, from taking antibiotics unnecessarily and excessively, this is affecting nutrition, it's affecting cognitive function, it's affecting our ability to lose weight, and it's affecting our overall cardiovascular wellness by leading to inflammation in our bodies. So the effects of all these improper diet, excessive antibiotic use, artificial sweetener use, having huge impacts on our health. And I'm glad you asked that question.
So again, that's obviously something that can be tested. I think, but the Genova test, test that one, right?
Yes, exactly.
So definitely check out your gut bacteria. See if you got leaky gut. Inflammation is definitely a big issue with leaky gut syndrome. You can make some very serious changes. And I'm hoping that just me on the plant-based diet is going to help. Sometimes I do that fizzy water with some, you know.
Oh, the kombucha?
No, I do the kombucha, but I also do the soda stream and then add sort of like my diet tonic. I hope there's not any sweeteners in that. I love that stuff. But anyhow, I really want to thank you, Dr. Kral. You're an amazing human being with a vision that is unfortunately lacking way too much in our world of medicine. And I can say that because I've been in this field for a very long time. I see what I see. And that's why I picked you as my doctor, so that I can optimize my health. But I want to thank you for today. Any last words?
Well, like you said, the 21st is coming up. So I just hope everyone out there watching sticks with all the resolutions they've made to maintain health. And not just for this year, but this entire decade. Healthy longevity is worth pursuing.
Excellent. Well, thank you for those words and for all those listening and all those providers out there wanting to make a difference. It starts off with the basics. It starts off with the foundation. Today, we discussed many of those foundational things that you could also support your clients in whatever aspect you treat them for that as well. I'm Dr. Bart Rademacher. This is your prescription for your transformation. Real people, real conversations, and real success. Till next week.
Thanks for listening to Dr. Rademacher's Prescription for Transformation. Join Dr. Bart Rademacher live right here on StarWorldwideNetworks.com or on demand 24/7.